Welcome back, the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are teaching America to persuade America, amplifying ethical-only persuasion. That's my brand. You don't need to use the nefarious, ugly techniques. Turns out we do just fine if we stay ethical. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques, so let's learn some of this stuff. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, escaped professor. They left the door open, and I'm like, you know what? I think I'm out of here. Late night comedy writer, stand-up, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. Have a new book out, 21 Colosseums of Persuasion, so check that out. On the podcast, I do three things. I talk to comedians about their politics and their careers, and I uncensor them. I let them do the bits that they can no longer do in comedy clubs because everybody's so triggerable. That's fun. I convert conservatives on the podcast. Send me a conservative, and I will talk them through some stuff. If you don't want to change your mind, don't talk to me because I've got skills. And that's fun. And then I interview persuasion professionals and social issue people and academics. And my big claim to fame, more rhetoricians than any other podcast on this podcast. I promise. My guest today, I'm really excited about this. And that's I'm authentically making that statement because I watched her movie maybe 3 years ago and loved it. I thought it was just a great encapsulation of some really complicated ideas. And she brings it down into a very real experience that I'm sure people relate to very well. She's the creator of The Brainwashing of My Dad, which is now a book that's just come out. And we're going to talk about that today. And we're going to talk about right-wingness and how the right-wing media changed a father and divided a nation, how we can fight back. That's my thing. It's fight back. So everybody, welcome to the stage. Welcome to the show. What do we say? Jen Cinco. Cinco or Senko?
It's Senko. But half of the family pronounces it Senko. Those are the ones who are more embarrassed about the ethnicity of it. And then the rest of us, we go Senko.
What are they embarrassed? What's the ethnicity embarrassment based on? Hungarian? Well, like, is that what you said?
Ukrainian. When I was growing up in the 60s, I felt really kind of un-American. And so did my family. And we were sort of, well, my dad was really, really, really super Ukrainian. And I think both my brothers were embarrassed. And I actually was so tan because we stayed outside all summer catching fireflies and going to the beach. People thought I was another race. So I was really embarrassed about my last name for a while, but I just picked up the way my dad pronounced it, Senko. And then both my brothers decided that, no, they were going to Americanize it and say Senko.
Interesting, because that doesn't seem like, at first glance, like a heavily ethnic name that would be plucked out by people. It seems like that's a fairly Americanized name already.
You'd be surprised. I mean, 60 years ago,
the range of different was very small back then.
Or
the range of normal.
Yes. I wasn't normal.
Well, give everybody, for people who don't know you and have not looked at the movie, and I've recommended your movie, I promise you, way over 100 times.
Oh, thank you.
It's one of the starting points I use because it's...
Thank you.
Yeah, that's why you're so rich. Because it grounds people in the story, like beyond the background and the intellectualizing background that you give to what happened, the rise of the right and the right-wing media. The story of you and your dad is just such a nice touch point. So just give us your essentializing of it, your pitch, and then we'll just wander.
Starting with my movie, like...
Sure, like...
I guess I could start with... for people that don't know my movie, I watched my dad change from a non-political, fun-loving Kennedy Democrat to a rabid, raging, right-wing Republican, cult Republican. This was way before Trump. And it started in the 80s when they moved, and he got a long solo commute to work, and he found Bob Grant on the radio. Bob Grant was openly a racist, a sexist. You know, he was like kind of one of the first big ones.
Right. And he's completely gone now, like from the consciousness. People know Limbaugh, but they don't remember, you know.
Limbaugh, and a lot of people learned from Grant, Hannity and Limbaugh. He was the father of conservative radio. But so anyway, I watched my father changed. And as it was happening, I was thinking, I wish I was filming this. This is just like watching a horror film unfold in right. front of me. But then I'll tell you what made me really suspicious of the whole thing is once he graduated from radio, he retired, and then he was listening to Rush Limbaugh. And Rush Limbaugh got him into the whole right-wing sphere and bubble. And then my dad started emailing. He was an engineer, so he kind of started early. And there were all of these, every email was bashing Democrats, making them unpatriotic, cowardly, just the scourge of the earth. You know, they're ruining America. They're not only ruining America, they're just ruining the very ground they walk on by just being alive.
Right. And, which is essentially, if you track it back in the history of propaganda, just put the word Jewish in for liberal and you'll understand why that pattern is so powerful.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. They don't call you a doctor for nothing. So I had never heard anything like this before. We you know, when I was little, we weren't conscious of Republican, Democrat. You know, to me, everybody loved Kennedy. You know, I never heard. And then racism, you know, everybody was like, oh, we have to be really nice to Black people because they've been fucked over so much by whites, you know, and you kind of were like conscious of that. But then I started realizing that this was like a movement. There was something happening. And then, you know, especially when Clinton was president, it was like, as much as they could, he was pretty, you know, far right. He was a little bit center, maybe some people say center left, center right, but whatever. He was kind of going with the flow of conservatism that was happening, that was, you know, coming into being. And yet they were still bashing him. And I realized it's just because he's a Democrat. And it was the same thing with Obama. I knew Obama was going to be bashed. It wasn't just because he was Black. Sure, that was an added bonus that they had, you know.
Yeah, it makes him more bashable, right, in American culture.
But any Democrat, they are going to bash because that was their purpose. So, you know, I began, like, I'd sometimes watch Fox News or I'd listen to them and these, like, you know, I'd look at their faces and I'd be like, that's phony anger. That's fake. They're trying to make people angry. And then like this also phony, like, intellectualism, like, we're really serious people right now. And I'm going to tell you that there are doubts about climate change. We've got scientists that, you know what I mean?
Oh, so sure, yeah.
I just started putting it together. And if you want something really personal, I'll tell you why I think that I was really tuned into this is because, like some other kids, I was really bullied as a kid. And I think I became hyper aware of tactics.
Bullyism? Sure.
Yeah. And I'm like, they're going to do harm to the Democrats. I know it because this was how my reputation and my, you know, was ruined. This stuff hurts, and it does affect people. So that's why I made the movie. And then, you know, I started doing research and just reading more. I was never political before that, but I was really alarmed by this phenomenon. And I felt like I had to like ring the bell and tell people. And I really thought more people would listen, but alas.
Well, maybe I can help you with some of that. Like, well, we'll talk about this because to me, again, you know, when you talk about the rise of the right, and you do a great job in both the movie and the book of detailing, you know, how that happened all the way, you know, even back to McCarthy and, you know, but definitely into Nixon and then through Reagan and, you know, the rise of the Bush and then the Tea Party and all that. You did a really nice job of laying all that out. But the idea that there's an infrastructure all the way from the rich down into think tanks who are writing scripts that are going down into Fox and right-wing radio, that idea that architecture is in place, most people can't even handle that as a concept. And right. Because they've never seen it hides itself within American structures. And I tell people, I have all sorts of little pry bars and what I call intellectual thorns that I drop into conservative minds as a technique, just so it's irritated to them. Like they can't get it out, but it ruins their experience of their media a little bit.
Cognitive dissonance, maybe?
A little bit of that, but it's more like, it's just an intellectual speed bump. It's a sour pill. And so if I can get enough of those in there, but like one that I start with is, you talk a lot about Fox, and Fox, I tell people, you know, that guy's not even American. Like Rupert Murdoch's Australian. Why did we allow a fourth network from a foreign power into America? Like if that had been China or the Middle East, if the color had been different of those people, we would never have allowed that into American network TV, but we did. And suddenly now we're wondering why this is different.
Well, Reagan made him a citizen, a U.S.
Right, but that's a fake citizenship. That's not real. He's still an Australian. He's a foreign power.
Right, right, right.
And if I can get that idea in their head, like he's not even American, and you're listening to him, since they're so pro-American, it makes a little thorn.
Right.
A little burr. Well,
I like that. I hope that hurts.
Well, and your movie is a great little thorn, a little burr of watching a very sweet man. Your dad, the way you portray him is so sweet. You clearly love this guy. Yeah. And it's so authentic and real and visceral. And then you watch him degrade, you know, emotionally and get into this storm, as I call it. And then you find a way to rescue him. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. My mom mostly did. She couldn't take it anymore.
Well, she shouldn't have to take it at all, right? I mean, that's the point. That should not, importing that into an American house is insane.
Yeah.
You would never let somebody come into your house and scream at you all day long like that.
I know. That's why I belong to this little Twitter group called Speak Up. And we kind of always want to try and associate the name Murdoch with Fox. So personalize it. So it's not just some, you know, entity that's sort of mysterious that's out there. But no, there's a family that's responsible for this, a father and a son. And they are doing this. And Murdoch has done this since Australia. He's gone into other countries, changed, bought up media, influenced people, got people in that he was able to persuade, make, you know, or change rules for him, bought more media, moved on to, he's like Pac-Man or Vulture.
Yeah, he's Darth Vader. He's going inside and we need to make that guy super evil in American minds.
Yeah. Now you're talking. Yeah.
Super evil. Like so evil, like he should not be allowed into America.
Right. I totally agree. I'm with you there. Yeah.
You put people like that in, like you did animation in a lot of your explanation in the movie. Yeah. I assume that's just, you know, that's a good way to, you know, kind of whiteboard it and make it fairly affordable to explain these concepts, because you can't go and interview these guys. And
right.
You know,
yeah. I tried to get Rush Limbaugh. He didn't pay attention to me until the movie came out. And then he had some things to say about it.
Well, yeah. And everybody, the nice thing from rhetorical perspective of unethical rhetoric, which is, you know, things like picking artificial targets and then just dumping all sorts of invective on them, is that you can do it to anybody. I mean, Trump was kind of fun at some point. Like, if I guess if it wasn't my culture falling apart, it would have been fun to just watch. He can turn anybody into a villain. Like yeah. His best friend the day before may be the villain next day. Because yeah. The guy was just a villainizer. That's what reality yeah. show politics is.
Yeah. He's a snake oil salesman. He has, like Mary Trump said, he has a certain charm you can see in the first 10 seconds. It appeals to some people, but doesn't appeal to others.
So talk about that. Like what attacks did you receive? Like what's been have you flamed up enough into the consciousness that the right has gone after you?
You know, not as much as we thought would happen. Rush Limbaugh had a rant on his radio, like the week that he came out.
What did he say?
I really kind of
commie lefty.
Like, yeah, probably something like this: lefty is trying to blame me for her father's changing. I don't remember that much. It was kind of unforgettable. I mean, kind of forgettable.
Sure.
But I get more like comments on YouTube or on Facebook, but not really. I mean, maybe with the book I'll get more, but I really haven't been harassed as much as I thought I would be. If it gets bigger, you know, like that's why I wrote the book, because I felt like filmmakers didn't get as much attention as like writers do. So I wrote the book. Plus there was more to say. You know, originally it had been a 3-hour movie. So I wrote the book so that it could get more attention. And so maybe I'll become a target. I don't know.
Well, and it's a substantive book. Like it's very well written, very, you know, researched. You've got bibliography, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's a book.
Thank you. Thank you. Shucks.
So are you going to try to get on right-wing outlets with it?
Fuck no.
That'd be super fun. You can say anything you want. Like get on Hannity and just throw that book in his face.
Only if you came with me.
I'll go. I love conflict with the right.
Yeah. I mean, I would probably just say, you know that you're bullshitting. You know that you're fake. And I know you're going to interrupt me. And I know you're going to be rude. And I know you're going to, you know, I don't even know if I would, like, sometimes I'm not that good at arguing, like, tossing that fact and that fact and that fact, you know, I'll freeze up. I'm just better with like, you know, you're lying. You feel good about yourself. That kind of
thing. Right. Well, I think that's one of the things, and I saw this during the Hillary Clinton campaign that bothered me. I'm like, y'all need to, one, hire rhetoricians so they can write some script for you that will protect you and will deconstruct their bullshit. Just saying you're lying and that kind of stuff, that's not enough.
Yeah.
And the second thing is you need to hire really good insult.
They wouldn't even say that.
Right, they'll cut you off, but.
But I mean, like the Democrats just didn't use to fight back. They just thought, well, we'll just ignore it.
Yeah.
You know, because it's beneath our dignity to respond. And that was bad.
Yeah, that I agree.
That was dangerous.
Yeah. And you can't run that traditional gravitas politics of we are moral, we are doing good things for the world, and just run that rhetoric all the time when you've got this screed coming at you over here. Like that was the debates, right? Watching Biden. I got to give it to Biden. The discipline, the only thing he basically said was, can you shut this clown up? That was the only insult.
Man, will you just shut up?
That is political discipline right there.
Yeah, but I think he was better than Obama would have been, because he just has a little bit of snark to him.
Yeah, he does. He has a nice little,
And it comes
he's got a little grin that says, yeah,
fucking right. But
that's the kind of stuff, again, like, so you need a rhetorician and you need a great insult writer. Like, if you write really good retorts about Hannity or whatever, don't answer his stupid questions. Just hit him with a good insult, which is the game. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, and watching Hillary go out when, you know, the debate when he had just gotten being the tape came out of Pussy Grabber, and her not using that to kill him off.
Yeah.
Bugged me. Like she had him shove the knife in his neck and finish him. And she didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the Democrats are just very, very timid and just too polite. You know, I mean, that breed of Republican declared war on Democrats, and you know, they brought AK-47s and the Democrats brought kittens to the fight.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, ultimately as a rhetorician, the only thing that really matters to me is public discourse, right? The morality of it doesn't matter. Who wins doesn't matter. What matters is the process of the rhetoric. And so you have these two rhetoric camps going to war with each other. And so the right comes up with nefarious rhetoric. And basically what they're doing is exploiting the code, the vulnerabilities in the democracy code and the public discourse code. Like they use free speech to be able to talk like this, even though this is a damaging form of talk to democracy.
Right.
And so we need to close those vulnerabilities in the code. We need a democracy 2.0, a public discourse 2.0, so that these people can't talk like that in public.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you are a very rational and reasonable person. You seem nice and well-intentioned. And I'm sure like you did research for your book.
Yeah.
Right. And those are all traditional moral ways of talking in public. But they would just come at you like, you know, banshees.
Yeah. Yeah. Rabid banshees.
So we got to get you ready to protect yourself.
Yeah. Well, I'm down with that. Yeah.
How do you shoot down a banshee coming at you?
Yeah. I don't know. You tell me.
Well, I think the thing about, like I said, you, almost everybody, and Stanhope's really interesting for this, you've got to earn the right, a legitimacy to say what you're going to say in public. Mm-hmm. And your legitimacy is your father's story. Mm-hmm. It's not because you spent a life in politics or you're a professor. It's, I lived this and I saw what horrible things it does to real people. Mm-hmm. And that resonates because so many people have had that experience and it gives you a legitimate place to talk from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think if you just keep coming back to that, like, hey, Hannity, you know what you did to my father?
Yeah.
You personally.
Yeah.
And don't let him pull you off that story because that's your moral center to your story.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. Although I don't think I'll ever get on Hannity's show.
We're going to get you on Hannity. Come on, let's do it.
Like I said, you're on it with me.
So what has been your experience?
I'll take the lessons first, though. I'll take
We'll get you ready.
Yeah.
Get you be a little like Iron Woman. Get you some armor and some weapons to handle the situation. So what has been your, tell me about this, the movie, like how it came together and your promotion of it and your experience of all that. Cause it's, like I said, it's really well done.
Oh, thank you. I just doing a movie is magic, and doing this movie was magic. I had done a couple other documentaries before that, but never one of this scope and not, you know, a feature length, like 55 minutes, both award winning. And so I was like in my 50s and I said, okay, I have the confidence now. And I keep getting fired from these freelance jobs because I don't give a shit anymore.
I can relate to this.
I'm going to commit to doing the movie. You know, either I do it or I don't. Now is the time to do it. So, I had saved, I was good at saving money. I had saved, like, from the freelance jobs, just a minimum of $10,000. I put that away so that, you know, I could buy equipment, buy cameras, you know, get basic editor and get some interviews together so that I could get a trailer together. And I got a trailer together, and then I went on Kickstarter and I had so many people respond. You know, over 900 people responded. And I knew Bill Plimpton previously. He's the animator. He's the Oscar-nominated animator. I knew him since, you know, my 20s. And a friend suggested, he was running a Kickstarter campaign at the same time. She said, why don't you get him to mention the campaign? Ask him if his person that was running the campaign could mention my campaign. And so that was Adam Rakoff. And so that's how I got introduced to Adam. And Adam is like, he's a partner with Matthew Modine. They have this production company called Cinco Dedos de Películas. And before I knew it, Miracle One happened, and that was that Matthew wanted to be involved somehow, any way he could. He just wanted to help because he thought it was that important. And I had always admired him, you know, as an actor and as a human being.
Vision Quest.
What?
Vision Quest.
Yeah. Well, he's just he's a very ethical person. He comes across that way.
Yeah. Full Metal Jacket. All these little, you know, subversive movies.
Yeah, and he's done his own, like Jesus Was a Commie, and you know, he brought that to Michael Moore's Film Festival. I was asking for a certain amount of money, but I ended up getting three times that, but it still wasn't enough. So then miracle number two happened a couple months after it ended. The Kickstarter ended. I had someone write to me and say, do you need more money to finish your movie? And I was like, yeah, you always need money when you're doing a movie. It's just endless, the amount of money you need. And that it turned out to be a really rich guy. I didn't know anything about business in terms of, you know, partnership, but we got a contract together, and he basically helped fund it. Though I can't tell you how many times I've been accused of having George Soros fund my movie. I'm like, nice. Believe me, if George Soros funded my movie, it would have a lot more marketing, it would have a lot more flash and boom and this and that. You know, I had all these people on board, but before that, you know, to get the trailers, I knew I had to get some heavies, like, you know, so that's when things just started rolling out. Like I got Jeff Cohen through somebody I met at Occupy Wall Street, and I let her sleep on my couch, and she told me about Jeff Cohen, so I got Jeff Cohen. And then I was trying to get David Brock, and they gave me Eric Bollert, who I'm a big admirer of. And then another friend of mine who liked The Vanishing City, which was our previous documentary, she said, well, why don't you ask Noam? I'm like, Noam Chomsky? Yeah.
That guy?
And she's like, yeah. I don't know him. I know him. I, you know, did WBAI radio with him. So I'll tell him you're going to contact him and, you know, what it's about. It's about media. It's about your dad, right-wing media and all this. So I couldn't believe it. He agreed to being interviewed. And so that's how I got some of these wonderful, wonderful interviews. And I'm telling you, when you're like on this creative role, things just happen. But maybe you know that from writing books. But when you're doing a movie and you need other people, it's just amazing what happens. You know, oh, I have this. Oh, I have that. Oh, can I help you here? Can I help you there? And, you know, there's nervous breakdowns along the way. But ultimately, you know, it's a, I can't think of the word, but it's a group thing.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, you need a little tribe of people. And so that was a wonderful experience. And my dad didn't mind being filmed at all. You know, he thought he was fascinating. So,
nice.
I mean, once in a while he'd mind, you know, when he was eating or something and he'd be, hey, get out of here. Otherwise, he was very natural in front of the camera.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And again, the, you know, the discrepancy between the sweet guy clearly coming through, but then the agitated person, you know, had been basically inhabited by the demons of this rhetoric.
Yeah.
And it was just so clear that, oh, that's not him. That's an odd way for that human being to be talking right now. So.
Yeah. Like night and day. But I feel like we have, this is a non sequitur, but I feel we have a almost like whatever amount of the country, a third of the country is now brainwashed. And I remember when I first named the movie and the investor was like, oh, no, we got to stay away from brainwash. That's too hot. That's too, you know, politically charged. And I fought for that. And I said, yes, but whether there's brainwashing, whether there's such a thing or not, this is what it feels like. And this is what it feels like to people, and people will be able to relate to the title. And, you know, on that alone, they'll want to watch the movie. You know, it turned out I was right. And then as we met, you know, neuroscientists along the way, I learned that, oh, there really is such a thing as brainwashing. And now we can see that like a large part of our country can be brainwashed, like millions and millions of people. And Eric Bollert, who has this great, column called Press Run, he calls them brainwashed COVID zombies. But they're not just COVID zombies, they're zombies. Sometimes I feel like it's like The Walking Dead. Like you have a friend and you watch them change and you're like, oh no, they've been bit. And then you see this change come over them. And it's strange. It's like, well, I see my friend, their body's there, but
yeah, it's one of the concepts. Again, like I've thought about this a lot, about what is the rescue conversion system to get people back, you know, and you have to first understand how they got where they are so that you're matching up the right rhetorical technique to that person in that situation. And that, you know, you talk about it quite a bit in the book about neural pathways and neural, you know, genesis and what happens when you change a neural network. You can't change that back just with a conversation. Like brains grow neural pathways because of repetition, intensity, stimulation, all these things that the right uses very strongly through its media. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to break into that, you have to approach it from, okay, here's how you approach a brain that this has been done to. And it frustrates the left incredibly because they try to use logic. I'm like, logic has nothing to do with it. You're in the wrong arena. Move over to technologically, neurologically retrained brains and go, oh, here's how you work with those people. And you might get somewhere, but again, nobody gets that training. They look and go, that's weird. Yeah, it's weird because the brain has been reset to something that's not real. And so it's going to look weird, but you can't logic it away.
Right. A simple way of looking at it is that they're not thinking with the rational part of their brain. Their amygdala, which is the fight or flight center that reacts to, you know, it's focused on survival. That's what's activated. So they're not capable of thinking rationally. And essentially, you kind of have to deactivate their amygdala somehow to bring them back to their rational brain. And sometimes questioning will do that, you know.
It's again, this is why I did a series of webinars, free webinars on this, and I took them down because I want to make it more focused for people because it's complicated. But if you are going to talk to that kind of brain, you know, like you said, the first thing is you can't continue to inflame their amygdala. You know, you can't be a source of more inflammation. So mm-hmm. you have to be, and you see therapists, this is one of the things you learn as a therapist, is to not incite with who you are, the person. That's why they come across as so flat a lot of times, mm-hmm. because they have to be not an emotional trigger for somebody. Mm-hmm. And you have to use, if you import some of those techniques over into talking to people that have been brainwashed by this system, then you can again start to make some headway because you're not just going right into their major emotional minefield. You're going to lose every time because they can't control that.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You just connected a couple more dots for me.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that you do again with the father-daughter story. It's such a disarming story and such a sweet story that it's going to be hard for people to watch that and get more upset unless they're worried about your dad, which is definitely in there. You get anxiety and dissonance about, but you have a happy ending.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the American mainstream American film genius is, we're worried. Look at that. Right. She got a happy ending.
Everybody likes a story with a happy ending, no matter how intellectual they are.
Yeah. And then we've been trained to that. That is the genius of the American story, is that it forces a happy ending into every situation.
Unless you're like my ex-boyfriend who never wanted a happy ending because it just wasn't real enough.
Yeah, well, we'll see about that.
Cranky.
No, it's a superpower. It's a super powerful story structure, and you used it very well, I think. So,
yeah. I think what does upset some people of watching the movie, they're often afraid to watch the movie that they're going to get angry or frustrated or fearful, like when they see the vast right-wing conspiracy, when they see the web that was woven, when they see like the tactics that the right has used and, you know, just really what's been employed in order to gain their ultimate goal of one party rule. They're afraid they're gonna, often people say to me, they're afraid, like on Twitter, they'll say, I wanna watch it. I'll watch conversations with other people. They'll say, you have to watch this movie. Oh, I'm afraid to. Well, no, go ahead, watch it as a happy ending. Oh, really? Yeah. You know, that's where they could get upset. But like you said, it's almost unfathomable that there could be such a conspiracy. Now everybody wants a conspiracy theory. So I offer them this one. Like, you want a conspiracy theory? Here's one that's real. You know, they conspired to have one party rule and had a certain way to go about getting it.
Yeah. And again, they're exploiting flaws in the democracy code. And I don't even hold it against them. Like from a, again, just a straight up rhetorical perspective, that's what people are supposed to do. That's what rhetoric is supposed to do. And even in America, America's a culture that can be reset. Sometimes, you know, we want it to be reset morally, but we have a free voting system. If we get enough people to vote for an evil empire, American system says, okay, they got the most votes. So they're exploiting flaws in democracy and their will to power, you know, pseudo-Nazis, you know, come to power because the Nazis did the exact same thing in the German system. And so, yes, morally and ethically, I would clearly have problems with them, you know, but rhetorically, if you have not protected your system and the other side sees flaws and exploits them, that's your fault.
Because we didn't read your book.
Well, we've never had to. America's always had this right wingness, but it's been tiny. It's been the KKK. It's been in basements and handed out flyers.
But well, now, I remember the Birch Society. I don't know if you remember.
Right? Yeah. It's been around.
A flyer like on our door, and my parents are both like, "Oh, they're nutty," you know. And then later, my dad comes to be spouting exactly what they were spouting.
Yeah, because the distribution system came into being and the production quality. Like they could actually produce this messaging as radio, great radio. Rush Limbaugh, for all his evil, was an amazing broadcaster, super talented, could flow that invective, had a great voice, all that stuff that you need to do radio, he was great at.
He knew he had to get people angry, and then that was the hook.
Well, that's what the media does. The media is an emotion machine. That's it. It doesn't give out information. That's pseudo information. It's an emotion machine.
Right.
And they're great at it.
Yeah. Sometimes I can't take it.
Oh, it's awful emotion. It's like I say, it's damaging to the culture.
Yeah.
But we have to defend ourselves. They are not going to stop.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. You know, I'm always recommending Hear Yourself Think. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They're friends of mine, and they actually have helped deprogram people. And through this Socratic questioning and stuff like that, they're just two ordinary people that were, canvassers and, volunteers for Democrats. And they were used to knocking on, like they both knocked on over 500 doors. Anyway, I often recommend them because sometimes they'll have a Zoom workshop. Also Stephen Hassan, but he's like the real deal. He's like a cult expert and, people pay him $300 an hour to deprogram their family members. But I'd be happy to recommend your book and stuff. It sounds really good. It sounds like it's really good information.
Yeah, it's a start. It's like I said, it's a start. I cover so much because I want to get people at least oriented and then like to understand what it means to have a production, high quality production media that can do that kind of stimulation. And to expect people to be able to resist it or defend themselves is silly.
Yeah.
Because even like, when you train a dog, the little clicker you have?
Yeah.
Trains a dog, give him a reward, give him a click, give him a reward, give him a click. The Fox does the same thing with stings, you know, and light changes and color changes. And you can't defend your brain from it, which is why smart people end up getting absorbed too.
Oh yeah. Well, there is something about television. I mean, it's a really unique medium and it's hypnotic. I mean, you turn the TV on in front of me and I can get absorbed in just about anything. Almost.
Well, if you ever do this, like turn the lights out in your house and look at your TV from the side.
Yeah.
And watch, it's constantly going on and off. It's constantly right. dark and then back on. You don't see right. the images switch, but they do. And yeah. that's literally a slow strobe.
Right, right. Hypnotizing you. Yeah. But then also too, like the people on Fox, there's visuals. There's visuals and it is visual. So, I mean, Limbaugh really knew how to make an audience angry and agitated. But on top of that, like Fox, you have these people that are dressed like news anchors. They call themselves news. And yet they act like they're so angry and so outraged. Well, surely they must be telling me the truth. So there's all these other manipulation techniques. And then on top of that, you know, like you were saying, like TV is sort of hypnotic, and then they have these bright colors. And
yeah, it's an interesting form again of rhetoric. It's facadism. I call it facade rhetoric, where you just inhabit the other side's pre-established, pre-trusted formats. And that's why Fox had to go as news, even the fair and balanced thing when they first started and all that, so that they could be the wolf in sheep's clothing, to the point where they could get all this new rhetoric in under the facade of a very established, trusted system. I tell people sometimes when they're like, well, I want to hear both sides. You know, hear all the things that the right is forced into their minds to keep their minds open to their rhetoric. I'm like, there are no two sides to news.
Exactly. Like,
when you watched Walter Cronkite, nobody said, yeah, but that guy is spinning the news. The news does the news. There are other perspectives in the world. And if you want to go get those, great, because there's about 500 of them for every single event in human history.
Right.
Great, go get them. But don't tell me this is another form of news. It's not.
Right. I mean, that's the whole thing that David Brock made me aware of, was objectivity. You know, he said that's what news was about during the days of like Walter Cronkite, like just discerning the truth. And I remember as a kid, I think, gosh, it was so boring. You know, he's
well, they took like, all the emotion out of it. That was really the point.
Nice uncle, like a really nice uncle, but I didn't want to be in the same room with him, you know. Nice guy as a kid, you could tell. But that was objectivity that he used. And what the Republicans did, especially after Goldwater lost, was try and make that objectivity seem like liberal bias. Because it was the truth.
Right, truth is liberal.
Truth has a liberal bias, or liberal bias is the truth, something like that.
Yeah, well, truth itself became set up as a liberal concept.
Yeah. Wow, dig into that a little bit.
Well, just the idea that searching for the truth and using qualified evidence, all the things that you know, as my second book that I'm working on is called Why America Can't Think. And it's essentially the breakdown of logic. Like, logic is a bad system. It's very easily broken and almost nobody can do it well. And so what the right did was like, look, everybody trying to use this pseudo logic. We can literally drop a new logic on top of this format and it's going to look like logic and nobody's going to be able to tell the difference. And so liberals want to hold things to the ideals of logic, like objectivity. Like, people know that if you have self-interest, strong self-interest in an argument, mm-hmm. you're going to skew that argument more than likely. Mm-hmm. That's a good logical principle. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way it's played now. Like that's seen as liberal. No, that's just logic.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So they've fused logic and liberalness, which destroys logic, which lets them replace it with skewed logic.
Well, that was done very subtly.
It's just an inhabitation. They literally just inhabit logic.
And how do they inhabit logic? Like,
by talking like they're being logical, even though you can go, that's not logic.
Like what I was saying, how they'll act intellectual and
they're acting logical.
Yeah. And you know, it's talking about the acting, it's always a little over the top.
And yeah, because that's a better signal. That's entertainment acting.
But also they're just bad actors because they really want to come across as intellectual.
They are awesome actors. It's soap opera acting. It's over the top.
It's soap opera
acting. It's super signaling.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And you see it and like, that's not real. And that again is a logic principle. Like, yeah, I should be able to discern between real and unreal, true and untrue. Those aren't at play anymore.
Yeah. That's really frightening.
Maybe it's just a system. If we understand what it is, we can counter it.
Yes, but how do you get millions and millions of us to understand? I've been screaming up and down, you know, for 20 years about this. And finally, now people are paying attention, which is a good thing. But, you know, we need our officials to also act. I don't have all the answers, but surely some really, really smart people can get together in a room and come up with some, like,
maybe. Nope, they can't. You know what they need? I said this at the very beginning. They need rhetoricians. I fight a lot of times when I do consulting for businesses, I'll come in and I'll rework their persuasion according to my theories instead of their theories. Mm-hmm. And I start by saying, okay, awesome to be here. I'm looking forward to this, but you guys all have SPS. And they're like, well, what's that? I'm like, that stands for smart people syndrome. You think smart people can figure out creativity, and you can't. I can bring crazy brains in here from comedy or, you know, language, you know, nerds, and they can write you new slogans and new phrases and new names, and they can just do it because their brains work like that. If you get in their way, they won't be able to do it. And the same way with rhetoric, like this, smart people think they can understand what the right is doing, but not unless you have the technology of understanding the rhetoric, which is kind of what you've laid out as well by showing that there is an architecture, there's an infrastructure here. You've made it real.
Right.
So that's very, very useful because now it goes from the abstract ether into, oh, I can kind of see it and then I can fight it.
Right. Yeah.
So they need rhetoricians.
Okay, I'm going to learn how to be a rhetorician.
Awesome. You are a rhetorician. You just haven't got all the formal training.
Right.
That would amp you up. But okay. You are definitely an informal, very effective rhetorician.
Well, that makes me feel good. I think I'll have a glass of wine after this.
Like you had a purpose in mind to fight the right, recover your dad, and you created a message, a very sophisticated message that did that. You landed a few torpedoes in the right.
Yeah. It's really funny because I don't feel sophisticated myself. I don't feel like I'm extraordinarily intelligent or articulate, but I could see this movie. I could see the whole thing. I understood exactly what had to go in it. And then I was only too happy to write the book to be able to add some more detail to that. It could have been, they cut it down. It really could have been a lot more. I could have gone on and on.
I want to see the full cut. I want to see the director's cut with your commentary. I want to see it.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you're an intuitive rhetor is what, you know, you feel your way through it. You're a smart person. You can see what's in front of you. I think my argument is always, let's take the intuitive rhetoricians, the moral people trying to do good things in the world, the intelligent people, and give them more sophisticated artillery. And that's what rhetoric offers. It's like, that's what I said, this training is supposed to be, let me arm you so when you go into Hannity, you can decimate this dude. Because that's what needs to happen, is we have to, when you're fighting very nefarious, sophisticated enemies, you can't walk in there with a slingshot. You know?
Right. Or kittens.
Although I would watch you throw a kitten at Hannity.
You'd what?
I would watch you throw a kitten at Hannity. That would be a strong moment. Everybody would pick that up.
Hannity would definitely get hurt because they get kind of wild there.
He threw a kitten in Sean Hannity's face. He would be super famous, just like that.
Oh, I would love to do that. I'd hate to do that to the kitten, but
kitten would be fine.
Yeah, no, that's true. They just attach themselves to him.
Do that. Okay, so that's our first. That's our first tactic.
Yeah. So here I know you're supposed to be interviewing me, but I'm interviewing you a little bit. That's the filmmaker in me. Would you ever consider coming on a like a podcast where you could sort of teach people? Because there are a couple of groups, organizations like DDAD, which is Defenders of Democracy Against Disinformation, Rise and Resist, Persist Brooklyn. These guys, they had my film. They really understand the harm that right-wing media is doing, and they've come up with means to combat it and fight it, and they have plans. So sometimes we'll have like a guest come on the podcast, and I'm just thinking like you would be so good, like if you had like a little intro or something. Do you have that?
Yeah, that's
just, you can cut this part out later, right?
Yeah, we'll work this part out. But so what happened with me was I have a digital marketing agency here in Austin that I started with a partner who's actually a business guy. I'm not a business guy, and he's a technical guy and stuff. And and so I've done a bunch of work for businesses the last 5 years, which has been interesting. But the pandemic slowed our marketing agency down so much that I'm like, well, I like to be busy. And then it froze down here in Austin for, over a week. And so that's when I wrote my book, because the thing slowed down enough to give me enough time. I've been working on this stuff for 30 years. So I've got a huge trove of notes and ideas. So it allowed me to amalgamate that. What?
How could you even type that fast?
I'm fast. Like, this is the stand-up in me. Like, I'm a burner writer. And it's not as dense as yours. Like, I tried to lay out the ideas in a basic, interesting way. Mm-hmm. But from my time, and I wrote a dissertation. I'm not going to do a bibliography anymore. I'm not going to do, I don't care. That's not the way I like to do things.
Right.
But so what happened was, I'm like, okay, I got time. And I started going, I'm going to start a podcast and I'm just going to do it. I don't care about marketing it or anything else. I'm going to get used to doing it. And I'm going to teach people this stuff on the podcast. And so I'm getting close to 100 episodes now, and I kind of got my feet underneath me about what it is. So yeah, now I'm ready to start talking to people, because I grew up in Kentucky. I was the first person from my family to go to college. I know what great information does. Yeah. I know the change that it brings to everything.
Yeah.
And seeing that people aren't getting this stuff from the field of rhetoric,
yeah,
just really kind of irks me.
Made you, again, sorry to be interviewing you, but what made you, when did you first, what made you first aware of rhetoric? Like, what made you focus on that?
Very surreptitious. Like, I was a writer and an undergraduate English major, and mm-hmm. then went to grad school because I couldn't find a job I wanted to do. And a professor that I like just sent me to a speech comm department instead of an English department, because I kind of did a double major. And I got there, and the first meeting I had, like the week before classes started, was with the chair of the department. And his name's Rod Hart, still a good friend of mine, great dude. I walked in and I sat down. He's like, so what are you here to do, to study? What are you looking to do? I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, what do you got? And he's like, well, he laughed. He's like, most people come to grad school because they have a focused academic interest that they want to pursue. And I'm like, well, that's not me, dude.
Yeah.
What do you do? And he goes, he laughed again. He's like, I do rhetoric. And I'm like, cool word. What does it mean?
Yeah.
And we got along really well. So he made me his teaching assistant for the large persuasion intro course at UT Austin. And I loved it. It's the most depth and still application. Like, it's philosophy, but applied through language. And it's just so deep that my brain has always loved it. So
Yeah, it's kind of like it was made for your brain, like it was a natural fit.
And it has, again, my working classness, it's got value to the community. It's not just an academic, you know, wander, which have value too, but not the same way.
Yeah.
That's why, like with you, when I see things like somebody has created a nice piece of creativity, you know, an actual film, and it's got depth to it. And I'm like, that's awesome that you've put that into the world so it can have effects.
Thank you. I died tomorrow. I'd die happy because I made that film.
Yeah, I totally can understand why you say that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was something I kind of wanted to do for 20 years since the 80s, and then it came together.
The book too. I'm like, did the book just come out?
It's coming out October 5th.
Okay.
That's the publishing date. Yeah. But I had been working on it for, like I said, you know, it's like, how can I push this message out even more? You know, like, I had wanted the film to really like blow up and, you know, be all over the place and have people talking about it on like on CNN, MSNBC, and, you know, ABC, whatever. So that things could change. And then, so I said, I kept noticing authors, they always had authors on. So I said, okay, I'll write a book. And I was working on it for about a year and a half when I was on vacation in Crete. And I hardly ever look at my emails when I'm on vacation. It's like, I just, you know, detach.
Sure.
And I got this email from Sourcebooks that said, hey, you know, regards to your movie, would you ever consider another venue of publishing, like a book? I'm like, well, funny you should ask.
I've been prepping for this moment.
Yeah, and that was 2 years ago. It was supposed to come out last year, but then COVID happened, and you know, the publication company was pretty much shut down, and I thought the book was done, and you know, everybody's saying, oh, this is perfect timing, and I had wanted it to come out sooner to just help, but this is just as good timing as any.
Yeah. Well, I'm really excited to see how it goes for you. Like, if you get a little more traction out, you have a new medium, you know, that reaches different people. And like you said, it has a different status to it. Are you doing the book tour thing or?
Well, I would like to. But they were saying that Sourcebooks, the publisher, were saying that people were not doing in-person book tours as much as they were doing, like, you know, Zooms and stuff like that.
Sure.
Because, you know, the variant and what have you. So, but I mean, I would love a book tour. I think that would be really fun. Although I would need a bodyguard or two, I think. and some lessons in rhetoric.
Yeah, that I think those two things, bodyguards and rhetoric training, and you'd be ready to go.
Yeah, so I have you as the rhetorician on one side and the bodyguard on the other, but I'll also have your lesson. So I'll be armed.
Yeah, for sure.
And then I'll have Kitten in the other hand.
It's bizarre that, again, there's so many things to look at when you start to study the right and this form of rhetoric. And the only thing I've told people for the last couple of years since Trump got in, I'm like, well, here's the progression. You know, at first they're going to win because of, we don't know how to defend this rhetoric. And then it's going to start to devolve because that will start to be countered and start to be less effective. And then they're going to go to violence. That's the only difference right now in this kind of propaganda and past propaganda. propaganda 2.0 hides the violence, like rubber bullets instead of real bullets. And, you know, it wasn't until like all the crazy militia, you know, unidentified cops and everything else came out during the BLM riots and things like that, we got to go, oh, this looks like an authoritarian party now, but they haven't left bodies on the ground. And that's the thing that typically brought down the other authoritarians, like the Stalins and all that, is bodies on the ground. And we still go back to the authoritarian, you know, Holocaust camps to show how horrifying it is. But that kind of proof isn't around right now. Like, we are still in abstraction land. So most people who would come to fear this stuff haven't seen it. It's clownery. It's guys in, you know, bison hats and, you know, all this stupid stuff. Even the Proud Boys haven't really done a bunch of violence. And so that's why I thought maybe the January 6th thing, but it didn't have a massive amount of violence either. It looked like a horde coming at democracy, but we'll see. I mean, that's the next stage. Once the rhetoric stops working, they will go to physical violence.
Yeah, I definitely think there will be blood. But I'm really scared for the country. If, you know, with Manchin and Sinema, if we don't get rid of the filibuster and we can't pass voting rights, there's over 400 bills.
I don't know. That's that's the inheritance of Gingrich, right?
They can change the electorates. It's not just suppressing voters. It's that they can change the people who are supposed to determine the votes to those that can decide the vote. And then if that happens, then I'm afraid Democrats will never win another race.
Yeah, we're about finished. I don't want to keep you too long, but there's so many things, like when you start to look at this more as a battle than than your culture and your life, just look at it as a general looking at a battle, right? Like, okay, yeah, right now, like they're doing two things. They've got this rhetoric machine that's pumping out all this very effective rhetoric. And then this is the inheritance of Gingrich. They've got gum up government so government can't protect itself. Which again is a flaw in democracy, that the government is that vulnerable. Right. That one person, McConnell, can hold up all of government for years and years and years, can change the Supreme Court. That's old democracy. It's going to have to be fixed on the ground, or they're always going to figure out how to break it. So you got to counter that, and you've got to counter the rhetoric. And both of those have to be done. And you're right. If they keep going over here unabated, they will gum up government to the point where they can run a one-party autocracy. Yeah. But we don't have to sit there and go, I'm worried about it. I'm like, well, here's what they're doing. Here's the tactics to break it and see what we can do there. So,
yeah.
Well, but you're part of that. You're putting out good weaponry.
Yeah.
To explain this stuff to people through your story and your research.
Yeah. And then thank God there's these other organizations now that are springing up that are like Rise and Resist. They're in front of, they have Truth Tuesdays. They're in front of the Fox News headquarters in New York every Tuesday holding signs.
Have you seen the comedians that are popping up? The gadfly comedians are going to the right-wing rallies with bullhorns. Walter Masterson, I think is his name. And they're just trolling the right.
Yeah. I did see one who was pretending he was a real fan of, who's the crazy woman with the blonde hair? Not Boebert.
MTG.
Yeah.
Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Oh, yeah, right. You know, acting like
that was Walter Masterson. He got in with her and what's his face. So that's a good, counter technique to troll the right.
Yes, it is. And it's also stigmatizing them a little bit, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just make them seem uncool.
Yeah. All that is very effective counter rhetoric. And that's what we need to design out.
Right. But like, then who's gonna do the counter rhetoric. You know what I mean? We have to equip the people in the news with counter rhetoric.
We do.
We have to convince them to use counter rhetoric. And then,
yeah, because you know, journalists are sitting ducks. Like all the traditions of journalism don't apply anymore. It's ridiculous to watch them during the Trump era and stuff, listen to those, you know, press secretaries and act like that was real talk.
Yeah, really.
Like being respectful. I mean, like, no.
What
don't.
Would you have done if you were there as a journalist?
Well, I would have done the things that, you know, I may have even jumped out of journalism because I was trained as a journalist, but I hated the constrictions. That's why I went over to comedy. Mm-hmm. Comedians don't follow those restrictions. I would have come up with counter comedy.
Yeah.
You know, and you saw it every once in a while. You'd see somebody say something and, you know, but it's endless. Like, I love talking about this. It's been super fun. I don't want to drag you on too long, but just arming the press corps with even just like signs that just say bullshit.
Yeah. You know?
So every time they say something, everybody just bullshit. And it's right there on the camera so everybody can see it.
Yeah.
Anything like that that gives them some artillery.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, we got to do this. We got to figure out how to do this. We got to get the people that speak to the journalists that do this. And there are some people I know that do this. So we'll have to talk more about this.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, this has been super fun. I hope we have adequately explained your book and the value of it and your movie, and that people should for sure, you know, check this stuff out because it tells it in a nice, understandable narrative way. And I really appreciate you doing that work.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you appreciating it. And I appreciate your work that you do too, because it sounds like it's really good and it's going to be very useful.
Let's hope so. Let's hope Aristotle can save us from all of this, because I think if we look back, he might have some things to say.
Yeah.
You know, people have been dealing with this stuff for centuries in different formats. And so, you know, cleaning up the public discourse so we can talk well and do good things with each other is kind of the game. So, well, awesome. That has been Jen Senko, talking about her new book and her movie. Get out there, buy the book, send her notes about how much you love it. And thanks, Jen.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
Yep. And we will see you next time on Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. Do you want to promote anything or before we go?
Well, they could go to, they could follow me on Twitter at BrainwashingDad or at Jen_Senko. Or go to the Facebook page, or if they have personal stories that they want to share, that they want to get off their chest, on the website, you know, The Brainwashing of My Dad, there's information about the book, but then also you can submit your personal stories. Sometimes people find that very helpful. And and you can also sign up for the newsletter where I'll be talking about like the next podcast I do, or, you know, when the book's coming out or this and that. So I guess that's, you know,
the core symbol in there is the brainwashing of my dad. If you type that in, you'll find all sorts of cool stuff. And again, like, it's well worth the read. I think the book itself complements the movie really well, and it gives you a chance to absorb the stuff that's coming at you towards the movie, you know, in the movie that the text you can look at, right? You can go back to and you can highlight. So it's a good combination.
Right, right. Thanks.
All right. Well, cool. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. Get out there and persuade some people. They need it.